I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Back in the summer of 61, someone broke a window at the Bay Harbor Pool Room in Panama City, Florida. When the police got there, they found the cigarette machine and the jukebox smashed open and money missing. When a witness told police that they'd seen that drifter Clarence Earl Gideon near the pool hall, it seemed natural. The man already had a long criminal record. Clarence was picked up, but when he got to court and asked for a lawyer, he didn't get one. What he did get was 5 years in a Florida state prison. Well, the history in this story is scribbled on a small piece of paper. From inside jail, that man wrote, quote, "I, Clarence Earl Gideon, claim that I was denied the rights of the 4th and 5th and 14th Amendments of the Bill of Rights." That's all he wrote. But that one piece of paper, which is now enshrined in the National Constitution Center, traveled all the way to the Supreme Court of this land, where the judges ruled unanimously that all defendants must be equal before the law. Clarence Gideon was released, and that should have been the happy ending to the story. Except that now, 40 years later, people all across America are still not equal before the law if they're poor. There's simply no money or no will to find the money to pay the lawyers who would represent the people who can't afford them. And that's our story this hour. We'd like to have you join us. The Constitution guarantees everyone the right to a speedy and public trial, but providing lawyers to people who can't afford them is expensive, especially when state budgets are already tight. So what is the fix? Are you willing to pay the price of justice for all? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're starting the program today with Sam Duhart. Sam was arrested in February of 2003 for drug possession. But he had to wait in jail for 6 months before he met his lawyer. Sam is joining us on the line from his home in Vienna, Georgia. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for joining us. Tell me, when you were arrested, did you at that time see the DA or make an appearance in court?
I did, but it was for ratification, for my probation ratification.
So you didn't see a lawyer at that time?
No, I didn't. A lawyer was there at that time.
Did you ask to see a lawyer?
Yes.
And what did they say?
I put a request in, and I did.
And then you went to jail?
Right.
And did you have the lawyer's name?
Yes.
So did you write him a letter or ask to see him?
Yes. I did no response.
No answer at all?
No answer until I came back to court.
How much later was that? 6 months?
August. I came back to court August 26, 2003.
And that was the first time you saw your lawyer?
First time.
Now, Sam, at that time, did he give you any useful advice, talk to you about your case?
No, he just gave me what the DA offered me. That was it.
Now, you could have got 10 years for this particular charge, right?
Right.
And the DA was offering some kind of plea bargain instead, right?
Right.
And your lawyer went to see the DA and did what? Just came back and said, this is what they're offering?
Right. Basically, right. That's it.
So no chance to discuss it, to say, hey, why don't we try this or why don't we try that?
No chance at all.
And so that day in court, what exactly happened when your turn came?
Well, I went before the judge, and the DA presented my case, and, well, we have came to an agreement. He served 10-3. But actually, I served 14 months, so 3 years. And 7 years on probation.
So you're still on probation?
I'm on parole right now. Once I get off parole, I'll be on probation.
Sam, tell me something. When you were in jail, were you talking to other people who were also just accused of a crime rather than people who were convicted?
Yes.
A lot of them?
Quite a few.
And when you look back at that, I mean, you're out now. Do you think that you were treated fairly by the justice system?
No, I wasn't.
Why not?
Because this system in Georgia is screwed up.
Where did you get let down?
At the public defender's office.
You're saying you should have had more time to talk with a lawyer to make a case?
Right.
Sam, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Sam Duhart joining us there on the line from Vienna, Georgia. We're going to go next to Tom Workman. And Tom's joining us also on the line. He's president of the Massachusetts Association of Court-Appointed Attorneys and a private attorney who takes on indigent clients. He's on the phone from his office in Taunton, Mass. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Now, just so I understand it clearly, private clients and doing some public defender work, that's your choice?
That's correct.
And when you do your public defender work, do you do it on a contract basis? You bid for the case? How does it work for you?
Well, in Massachusetts, we have 14 nonprofit corporations that represent the different counties in the state, and each of those have attorneys who sign up to do this work. And when you sign up, you're then assigned to a court on a given day, and that's called your duty day. So any client on that day who's indigent and can't afford an attorney and one is appointed for them is assigned to that duty attorney for the day.
And when did you last do a duty day?
I did a duty day this week on Tuesday.
And did you have a number of clients?
I picked up two new clients and helped two others in court that day.
What do you get paid for work with a client, Tom?
In Massachusetts, in district court, it's compensated at $30 an hour.
Does that cover your costs?
It does not.
Explain to me why.
Well, lots of people look at an attorney in court and they just see the attorney. What they don't realize is that you have an office that you come back to and. For example, when the connection called my office this morning, my secretary answered. I have a secretary,
mm-hmm.
and I have to pay her. The expenses for a secretary in this part of the state run about $15 an hour, and that's half of what I'd be compensated. Out of the other half, I'd have to pay rent, telephone, and all the expenses that go with running an office. It's really kind of like if you go to a doctor, you understand that when you pay the doctor, you're not just putting money into the doctor's pocket, but you're paying for the receptionist and the nurse and the equipment and all the things that go with running a professional office.
And so if you take a case at $30 an hour, it might be that you spend 2-3 hours on that person. You end up earning $100 for giving advice or representing that one person. Is that fair enough?
Sure. Typically, I think you spend about 4 to 5 hours on the typical district court case.
But if you don't make any money doing it, why do you do it?
I think people do this work because they're dedicated to the to defending the Constitution, and while that sounds rather corny, I think it's the reason most people do this work. They don't do it for the money.
But up to a point, I guess, because I understand that lawyers in Massachusetts are saying, you know what, enough. We're not going to work for these wages anymore.
Well, and that's the problem. I think many attorneys have come to the conclusion, a lot of them at the same time, that they simply can't afford to continue to work at the wages that the Commonwealth is paying.
Which means that at present, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of these people like Sam Duhart, are just cooling their heels in jail because they can't get a public defender, right?
Oh, sure. In fact, yesterday there was an update in the Springfield newspaper here in Massachusetts that said that the number's up to 79 people being held, or people that are without attorneys. That's just in Springfield.
Tell me a little bit about the kind of people who you are representing as a public defender. Are these people who might, under other circumstances, be able to afford a lawyer?
Most of them are really very poor. If you go into district court, you'll find the common thread is that the people are poor, that they're poorly educated. It's really unusual to find defendants who have a high school diploma. Just a short anecdotal story. I remember being in court one day a while back when the judge asked the defendant, how far did you go in school? And the defendant said, all the way, judge. And all the way meant a high school diploma. And for most of us who are lawyers, who have a doctorate degree in law, all the way would mean a PhD degree, not just a high school degree. But that's unusual to find people that are that educated. And they're really poor.
And so someone who's in there for bouncing a check might be in there because they're having trouble understanding just the whole system of how checks and balances and all that works?
Well, many folks don't know how to balance a checkbook, and a lot of the folks that are in district court are homeless. So while you or I, when we might bounce a check, the bank would send us notification to our house because we have a home and a post office box at our house, and then we'd go make the check good. These folks don't have any place to be notified. So whereas you or I would go fix this problem, they don't realize they're in that problem, and then when the bank tries to send them something, they don't have a mailbox to receive the mail, and so they get charged with the crime of larceny by check, and there they are in the criminal system.
And what's the fix here? Is it just getting politicians to focus on providing more money for better public defense?
I think the real problem is that politically it's a very difficult problem to solve given the way that politics works. And in politics, the politicians will all have their causes, if you like, and they trade off among themselves as to, you know, I'll support your bill if you support mine. And there's no one there, or practically no one, advocating for the indigent. There are a few courageous politicians, and I say that because to champion this cause as a politician is a political liability. And those politicians have been trying to bring this problem before the legislature to get funds allocated.
Are we also looking at other shifts within the system, Tom, though, where there are more people being arrested these days than there might have been 10, 20 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. I think 10 or 20 years ago, there wasn't the sensitivity around domestic situations, and the police would respond to a call, and they'd go out and tell the people, you know, stop the argument, be quiet, you're disturbing the neighbors. But today, if they go out, they arrest somebody. And that happens all the time, where we see people who were arguing but not fighting brought into court and charged with domestic assault and battery. The situation now is such that there's probably 10 times as many cases flowing through the criminal courts of indigent defendants than there was 20 years ago, and yet the pay has not changed in 20 years. In fact, the pay has gone down in many situations. 20 years ago, if an attorney stood up in court to argue for a client like the individual you had on the program just a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. they'd be paid $35 an hour in district court. Today they're paid $30. That's 20 years later and $5 less an hour.
And so the end result is a lot of those people are just sitting there in court, sitting there in jail waiting for representation because they can't get it.
They are. And, it's unfortunate, but the attorneys simply cannot afford to do the work at these rates. So they're basically saying, I can't afford to do this. I have to do other work. I can't do this work. In Massachusetts, the average right now is 900 hours per bar advocate. We call ourselves bar advocates. And that's a half-time job. In addition, there have been problems with the pay not being made in a timely fashion. Last year in August, the legislature didn't allocate funds to pay the bills until some 2 or 3 months after the end of the fiscal year. So people were left with bills to pay and no money coming in.
Quick last one, Tom, for you. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court says some people might just be released, charges dropped, if they can't get their speedy trial. Is that perhaps the best way to get the public focused on finding some way to find the money, to find the representation for these people?
Well, it really will be too bad if it comes down to that. I would hope the legislature would act before the SJC has to do something, but certainly you can't deny people their constitutional rights, and if you do, the remedy traditionally is to dismiss the case against them. If they dismiss the case, then they'll be released. We really don't want to see another Willie Horton-type situation where someone is released and then reoffends and somebody gets hurt. It's a public safety issue. And hopefully the legislature will, working with the governor's office, will fix the situation before something happens that's catastrophic.
All right, Tom, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Tom Workman is president of the Massachusetts Association of Court-Appointed Attorneys. He describes a situation in Massachusetts which, when you pull back the lens, we find all across the country. And it becomes a whole lot more complicated because it's different in almost every state that you examine. When we come back after our break, we'll be talking with people who can give us a better sense of what the national picture looks like and take us a little bit further into an understanding of what's going wrong with the public defender system in the United States. And your thoughts as well. We'd like to have you in. Are you willing to devote more tax dollars to representing people who can't afford lawyers? Is that part of the deal of living in this country? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, talking about the crisis that exists in the public defender system in the United States. We're joined now by Stephen Bright. Stephen is a lawyer and director of the Southern Center for Human Rights, joining us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Dick. Good morning.
And Judge Timothy Lewis is also with us. He's a former federal judge and prosecutor, a partner in the law firm Schneider, Harrison, Siegel & Lewis in Washington, D.C., and recently named co-chair of the National Committee on the Right to Counsel. Judge Lewis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Dick.
What is that committee, that brand-new committee?
The National Committee on the Right to Counsel was formed in conjunction with the Constitution Project and the National Legal Aid Defender Association to mark the 40th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Gideon versus Wainwright. It is a bipartisan committee, and our mission is to review the indigent defense system throughout the United States and to create consensus recommendations for some reform. As your two previous guests, I think, made fairly clear, this is a problem that is national in scope. It is endemic to our criminal justice system, and it is pervasive. And even though Gideon has been on the books for some 40 years, it is beyond time to add to its legacy by bringing it up to speed with where we are today.
And Stephen Bright, I find it kind of ironic that we started the program with Sam Duhart from Georgia, because when you look through what's being written recently, Georgia's supposed to be a shining example of a state that may finally be getting this right. Is that how do you see this?
Well, Georgia's an example of a state where it got so bad that something had to be done. I mean, it was just an absolute disgrace. And the bar and the judiciary, the judges, finally just became so embarrassed. I mean, we found in our office a man named Samuel Moore who was arrested for loitering one December and never saw a lawyer. He spent 13 months, a year and a month in jail. Turns out the charges had been dropped 4 months before he was finally released, but nobody bothered to tell the jail. So here's a man arrested for really about as petty a crime as you can imagine, loitering. He never sees a lawyer. He's never taken before a judge. This ruins people's lives. I mean, to spend two Christmases, 13 months locked up, and then be found by a paralegal from the Southern Center for Human Rights who says, by the way, what's this man doing in jail? And the jailers check around and find out, oh, we have no basis for holding this man. That's a pretty fundamental breakdown of the system. Or just recently, a death penalty case where the lawyer admitted that he was drinking a quart of vodka a day because he was so worried about the fact that he was about to be charged with a crime for stealing over $100,000 from some other clients. That kind of thing was happening all the time in Georgia. And it finally became a situation where something had to be done. Now, it hasn't been done yet. Starting January 1, Georgia will go from a system which left representation of poor people accused of crimes up to each of 159 counties, a hopelessly splintered, disorganized system, to a public defender system where there'll be one public defender in each judicial circuit, 49, which will pretty much parallel the prosecutor, the district attorney's offices throughout the state.
And Tim Lewis, when you were on the bench in Pennsylvania, were you looking at this range of cases that, Stephen's talking about, bad representation, no representation, poor representation?
Well, those did arise, but I was on the federal bench in Pittsburgh, covering the Western District of Pennsylvania, and then on the United States Court of Appeals. The federal system of defender services is, and I'm happy to say, a far cry better than what we are seeing in most states around the country. There are many reasons for that, and but suffice it to say that the instances of poor representation as a result of lack of funding and all kinds of other reasons that we are seeing throughout the country are occurring with far, far less frequency at the federal level. So while certainly I did see examples of ineffective assistance and poor representation or other situations that gave rise to questions as to whether or not someone's conviction was based on something that was we should accept, that did not happen at the same level in the federal. But I do want to say that what we are dealing with here really is, in my view, the dirty little secret of the criminal justice system in our country. People just aren't aware of some of the examples, such as the one that Steve just referred to. We are finding more and more of such instances throughout the country that, I mean, and that are even far worse than what he just described. To take the case of Johnny Lee Bell in Louisiana. This is someone who had been arrested for second-degree murder in January of 2002, and her public defender stipulated on the record in March of this year that she had only spent 11 minutes with Mr. Bell, preparing for trial, and that she had not had time to locate any witnesses, retain experts, file any motions, and so forth, due to her overwhelming caseload. And the judge in that case gave her a 24-hour extension to prepare for trial. As she was leaving the courtroom, the public defender then realized that she had a conflict of interest because she represented the victim's father, who was an eyewitness in this particular case. And then
she'd only just figured that out?
That's correct. And she then realized that she also represented the victim himself at the time of his death. The very next day, when she reported this to the judge denied a conflict of interest motion and ordered the trial to begin. The trial lasted 6 hours, and it shouldn't surprise anyone that Mr. Bell was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. now, why does this happen in America today? Obviously, this should not happen, and this is not limited to Louisiana, where, incidentally, funding for public defender services it occurs parish by parish, so that depending upon the revenue base for each parish, parish's funding is based upon traffic tickets that are issued by the police. So if the police are issuing more traffic tickets, then there may be more funds available for adequate defender services. If they decide to focus their attention elsewhere, then there may be less funding available. This is the kind of thing that should not be happening in this country in 2004, 40 years after Gideon versus Wainwright.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Taking our first call from Hull, Massachusetts. Denny's joining us. Hi, Denny.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
The basic problem with the district court system is that it is the prosecutors and the court-appointed lawyers feeding on the poor. They're known as bottom feeders in the trade. I was a bottom feeder. And the basis for it is twofold. First was when Weld, by reinterpreting the Concord prison sentence and parole eligibility, pretty much extended a whole bunch of guys' sentences, this truth in sentencing nonsense, because the judge, when he sentenced, knew exactly how much time the guy had to do. The earlier move...
Denny, let me take you back to your own word of bottom feeders. Are you saying that the system is set up in such a way that the only people who will work as court-appointed lawyers fall into this category?
Correct. They tend to be young lawyers related to politicians who are looking for work and need something to fill the day and hand out business cards.
So
I did as well.
Do you fix that by setting up a system as some places have where there are full-time public defenders, period?
You can. The better way to do it is the way Maine does it, which is that instead of having what they call district court felonies, crimes for which you can go to prison, they have everything is under 6 months, which removes the federal protection, and most of them are fines. And they then pay off the fines as they go along. The overcharging of criminal defendants, for instance, in the city of Lynn, there is not a single block that's not a school zone. So everyone comes in charged with school zone, and after about 20 or so continuances, when the DA gets paid, the cop gets paid, the probation office gets paid, the victim witness advocate gets paid, the clerk gets paid, they reduce it to possession and plead the guy out to the time he's already done.
Denny, let me, if I can, just turn that to Stephen Bright for a slightly broader look. That it's something that Tom Workman talked about as well, that the system is being so badly skewed that you end up having, as Denny's talking about, and Tom was referring, police making arrests that they might not have made, night clerks booking cases that they might not have booked because they make a little bit of extra cash, that all the way up the system, it ends up being a way for people within the judicial system, in a sense, to scam their own system.
Well, also, one of the things you had said when you were talking to Tom was about people waiting, and of course this is another example of waiting, but the other part of this and this volume coming in is that people are not represented once they finally see a lawyer. They're just processed. I mean, the people become almost like hamburgers at a fast food restaurant. I mean, Mr. Duhart, who you talked to early in the show, I mean, when he finally met his lawyer, it was for 10 minutes. The lawyer gave him the plea offer. He pled guilty. He was sentenced. Probably the next day, that lawyer couldn't have told you that he represented Mr. Duhart because he was only one of probably 40 or 50 clients that he met and pled that day. And, of course, the other consequence of that is the message that, goes out to the police pretty quickly is that you don't have to worry about constitutional rights like search and seizure, the way in which confessions are taken and all that.
Nobody's going to ask these lawyers, questions, right?
Yeah, these lawyers aren't going to file any motions. They're not going to challenge it. You basically arrest the people and, throw them in jail. And, often, as, was said, by the time the case finally comes to court, the people get credit for time served or just get sentenced to time served because they've already been in jail, particularly on these petty offenses. They've been in jail longer than any sentence they're likely to receive.
And, Tim Lewis, if, we take this to a not down the line of the bottom feeders that Denny's talking about, but the caseload that some people are dealing with. I was looking at...
Well, that's a very significant problem. The caseload for most public defenders throughout the country is simply staggering. Quite frankly, and
give
I...
Give me an example when you say staggering. You're saying like 100 or 200 a year?
Absolutely. And, if I can just to elaborate on the point raised by your previous caller, though, about bottom feeders, you could take Johnny Cochran or Mark Garagos or just plug in the name of your favorite criminal defense attorney in this country and put them in the same system that most public defenders in this country have to operate with, and you would probably get pretty much the same result. They could not function. The means are simply not there. The caseloads are such that there's a term called meet 'em and plead 'em. I'm sure Steve is familiar with that term. At the arraignment, frequently a lawyer who does not have the time to devote to a case, and this is something that should never occur, but will simply advise an accused of the options available on that day without having conducted any investigation and recommend that they enter a plea of guilty, whether it's a misdemeanor, typically to a misdemeanor. Again, this is in part because of the overwhelming caseload. But another problem is a lack of parity between the amount of resources that are available to the public defenders and the district attorneys throughout the country. And here I'm talking not only about salary, but about resources for conducting adequate investigations, for paying for transcripts, court reporters, just all kinds of needs that go into creating an adequate defense. You know, poor people in this country under Gideon versus Wainwright are entitled to more than just a warm body with a law degree. I mean, they are entitled to a competent, adequate, meaningful defense.
Okay, let me stop you for half a second. One thing I want to understand here. If Sam Duhart had, by some miracle, found himself a public defender who thought that the case was something that he could work with and said, you know what, I'm going to set everything that I'm working on aside. I'm going to concentrate on this because I think you've been treated badly by the police or the justice system. Are you saying that even if a public defender were able to find the time or set aside the time to protect or look after the interests of a client like that, the system is still stacked against them in terms of what the DA and the government resources are on the other side?
I don't think that there's any doubt about that. I think that's absolutely true, and I think that the statistics will bear that out. You know, there was a lawsuit brought by the ACLU in my home state of Pennsylvania against my home county of Allegheny because of the inadequacy of funding available for defender services. And I know the lawyers in Allegheny County, and I know the public defender. These are terrific people, and they're very well trained, and they're very good lawyers. But you cannot cut their funding, their budget, by 28% after the ABA has already found 2 years previous that office was one of the worst, most underfunded offices in the country in terms of resources, and expect an adequate performance by the lawyers. Fortunately, there has been a consent decree in that case, and much has changed. It's under court monitoring right now, but the answer to your question is yes.
To Columbia, South Carolina, and Jose's on the line. Hi, Jose.
Hi, I'm chomping at the bits, too, because I'm very interested in this subject.
All right.
And it's very frustrating to know that as a citizen and an individual that your chances of getting adequate representation if you're arrested for some minor or petty crime is going to be lacking. It's going to be completely inadequate.
Jose, anyway, you hear the politicians saying the same thing that I hear them saying, and they're saying they don't have money for schools, they don't have money for this, they don't have money.
They always want to cut taxes like it's a cure-all to everything. And I just wonder if everybody paid their fair share of taxes, like we ought to be doing, instead of cutting $2 trillion in taxes in 2 years, like the current administration did, would that help, help the funding be more adequate for people like the guest you first had on? I just wonder about that.
Is it, Stephen Bright, simply a matter of saying this is a higher priority? Our state, our country, is going to put more money into the support for the people who can't afford lawyers.
Well, that's part of it, but not all of it. I mean, part of it, too, is organizing and structuring it in a way that makes sense. I mean, we have many states in this country. A lot of people think that public defender offices are pretty universal. Not true. I mean, in states like Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, some of the states have a fairly large number of criminal cases that come before them. Pennsylvania is another example of a state that leaves it to the local jurisdiction to fund it. So
right,
the quality of representation varies greatly from one place to the other. But the other point of that is there's just no organization. There's no structure. So you're appointing, as someone said, these bottom feeders. You're appointing people who may develop an expertise and then go off and do something else. So part of what has to be done here is make a commitment to it, because it is constitutionally required. When people say, well, why should we spend this money? It's just as fundamental to this society. We spend money on a lot of things that are not constitutionally required that we think are fundamental, like our school system, because we obviously have to have that. The integrity and the legitimacy of our court system is equally important, and it's constitutionally required. But there just has not been for many years leadership, political leadership, on this issue with regard to how fundamental it is if the courts are to be trusted.
It's interesting. We spend so much time talking about integrity in the political system and picking through that part of the way that the country is governed. But when we talk about integrity in the judicial system, listening to the way that you, Steve, and Tim are both describing it, it shines quite a different light on priorities. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. The public defender system, it's obviously not working. What's it going to take to fix it? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon, and our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join our conversation this hour about public defenders in the United States, a system in some considerable degree of crisis. With me on the program, Stephen Bright. He is a professor of law at the Yale Law School and director of the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta, Georgia. And Judge Timothy Lewis is also with us. He is a former federal judge and former prosecutor, co-chair of a National Committee on the Right to Counsel. It's a new panel that's taking a look at public defense in the United States. And Tim, let me start. Sorry, did I mischaracterize that?
I just wanted to point out, Dick, that we're not only talking about the adequacy of counsel that's available to poor people. We're talking also about instances in which there simply is no counsel available for poor people because of screening mechanisms that are overly restrictive, that prevent defendants who lack the financial means from having any attorney, any public defender at all.
Simplifying that for me. Give me an example.
Sure, I'll give you an example. For example, although the state of Wisconsin, for example, funds and administers indigent defense services at the state level, which is laudable, that's good, the financial eligibility threshold is set so far below federal poverty guidelines that even people who are poor enough to qualify for Medicaid or for food stamps are considered by the state of Wisconsin to be able to afford their own defense. Anybody in Wisconsin who earns more than $3,000 per year is not eligible for court-appointed counsel.
But that's absurd.
Well, that's exactly right. And yet that is, as that is the system, the scheme that is at work in the state of Wisconsin.
And so, of course, it should be just the other way, because a person who's barely surviving on food stamps or public assistance or whatever, to go out and hire a criminal defense lawyer to get $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 together to do that is way beyond the means of many people.
And
most
so what
criminal
that, No, I'm sorry. See, that's exactly right. And so what that means is that people in Wisconsin who make less than who earn more than $3,000 per year but cannot afford an attorney are in the same situation that Gideon was.
They don't qualify for a public defender, and they can't afford a lawyer at the same time. So they end up, what, representing themselves in court?
That's absolutely right.
And that's in many ways against the law, isn't it? I mean, depending on how you want to interpret the Constitution, that's illegal.
Oh, there's no question about it. It brings up the great irony here, which is you count upon your lawyer to enforce all of your constitutional rights. But if you don't have a lawyer, there's no one to enforce any of your rights, including the most fundamental one of all, your right to a lawyer. I mean, I see courts all the time that operate without lawyers at all, and they're locking people up. And the Supreme Court has made crystal clear, you cannot take someone's liberty away unless you have provided them a lawyer. But there's no one there to step forward, except when we file a lawsuit against them, but generally no one is there to step forward to say, "What? Wait a minute, you can't do this. This is unconstitutional." Or when that person is put on probation and required to pay some fine that they can't even begin to pay, and 3 months later they fail to pay, and then the judge revokes them and puts them in jail. Again, there's no one saying, wait, judge, you can't lock people up for inability to pay a fine. You can't lock someone up who didn't have a lawyer at their trial or plea. And so in the absence of any lawyer, this lawlessness takes place in these courts.
We're going to Edenton, North Carolina next. Sam's joining us on the phone from there. Sam, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine.
I am a lawyer in Edenton, and our entire judicial district, they have put every single lawyer on the court-appointed list, including civil lawyers, old lawyers, young lawyers, and it really has worked fairly well. I mean, nobody's paid very well, and we're thinking about getting a public defender's office, but the criminal attorneys were so burdened by, you know, overloaded cases that the chief judge put us all on the court-appointed list.
So with everybody sharing that load, Sam, what's your share? How many do you have to deal with?
I probably do 10 a week, maybe, because we have seven counties in our judicial district, so you get cases from all those counties.
10 a week is still like 500 cases in a given year, though. I mean, that's asking you to deal with a lot of people without necessarily spending much time on each case.
Oh, that's true. Well, and I mean, you know, we're there for other cases. I mean, most of the people, the civil lawyers aren't. I think they've been the best sports about it. You know, you don't get paid. We get paid $65 an hour, which to some of the people in the courtroom seems like a lot. But when you know, take in overhead and fax machines, copy machines, and, you know, all those type of things, secretaries, you really don't even break even.
Sam, thanks for your call. Tim Lewis, what is the fix here? I mean, you're on a national committee which is taking a look at problems that are different in every single state. Are there principles here that can be applied in each case?
Well, please bear in mind that the committee has just convened, and we are just getting to the business of studying the problem and will, over the course of the next year or two, come up with recommendations and suggestions that we will be presenting to policymakers, politicians, legislators, judges.
Yeah, I'm not looking for a
so
final
forth.
Report here, but I'm yeah. but I'm saying
yeah,
if
let,
if it's
but let me just tell
different
you
a couple in every
of
state,
quick,
how do
a couple
you manage
of,
it?
Just a couple of quick things. First of all, I think that there should be state funding available in all jurisdictions for public defender services, and that funding should be, as I mentioned earlier, there should be some parity between the funding made available for the prosecution and the funding made available for public defender services. For example, in my home state of Pennsylvania, there is not one dime of state funding available for defender services. It is done county by county. What that means, of course, is that in some counties where the revenue base is considerably lesser, the availability of defender services will likewise be less. In places like Philadelphia County or Allegheny County, the funding would be different. And so we shouldn't have that. There should not be that disparity of treatment. I think that state funding, and I think that we need to have some federal involvement here. As Steve has mentioned, we're talking here about federal constitutional rights. I think that this is something that the Congress should take a look at, and we should consider the possibility of allocating funds for local defender services. The American Bar Association has, I think 2 years ago, adopted 10 principles for public defender services throughout the country, which contain, I think, some very fine recommendations that we are going to urge be adopted. So those are some of the things that we're going to be taking a look at, but we'll learn more and be in a position to present more as we go forward.
All right, Stephen, I'm going to check with you in just a minute on what you see as a way out of this. I want to go next to Lancaster, Massachusetts. Gail's joining us on the line. Hi, Gail.
Yes, hi. How are you doing?
Fine.
I've done this sort of work for many years. I became an attorney in 1977, and around 1980, I did this for several years, and then about 18 months ago, I did it again. I'm still on the list, but I'm getting off the list. I might stay on the list if I can stay on in some very limited capacity, because I like to do the kind of job I like to do on my cases, pretrial motions that might take me to court 10 times on a set of motions because the prosecutor doesn't want to give you discovery.
So how do we pay for that, though, Gail?
Oh, no, I don't even bill for it. I consider, I know what used to happen to my bills in the old days when I was young. You'd go in and the judge would say, well, you've been in 15 times on this case and so forth, and you've billed the state for $450, but I think your services are worth $75. So they put a line through it. Now, I mean, if you properly bill, I think they audit you. You go, and you don't get time paid for your billing. It's not worth it. To me, it's throwing good money after bad. Chase the real cases with the business clients or whatever else you have and make your money that way, knowing this is just what it is. But there are many ways you can reform the system, at least in Massachusetts, where we have so many lawyers. I think we have 40,000 lawyers in the Commonwealth. In my view of it, I wrote a lengthy article to the Globe, which didn't get published, but we don't pay for medical insurance for people who work over 40 hours a week in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I go to a little diner. You see the young woman working there. She works 25 hours a week there.
Gail, so what's your fix here?
My fix is there's no political will on the part of the people to pay for court-appointed lawyers, and they're not necessarily wrong. We live in a world of scarce resources. We don't pay for medical insurance for people who work more than 40 hours a week.
So are you saying these people shouldn't get representation?
In an ideal world, certainly. But what I'm saying is when you have a person and he has 18 assault and batteries on his record or he's had 18 court-appointed lawyers, up comes his 19th court-appointed lawyer, you do have to wonder about paying for the court-appointed lawyer under those circumstances.
Yeah, let me just stop you there, because it's a great place for me to turn this to Stephen Bright. We're not necessarily always talking about really good-hearted people with clean records, who deserve the love and care and affection of the state. In some cases, we're talking about people who might have 18 assaults on their record, Stephen. And so that's where people get a little bit edgy and go, whoa, do we want to be putting our scarce state resources into defense for someone like that? Is it about the client? Is that the way to look at it? This person deserves it, that person doesn't?
Well, it's to look at it this way. If we're going to have justice, I think Dr. King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And if we're going to have a system that's fair and that gives out fairness to each individual that comes before it, then we have to have that universally. We can't say, well, this guy had 18 prior, so we're going to presume he's guilty as opposed to give him the presumption of innocence on that case that everybody is entitled to. Sure, many of the people are going to be found guilty. I mean, one thing I should just say parenthetically is that one of the great consequences and tragic consequences of the poor quality of representation throughout this country are the number of innocent people who are convicted and sentenced to prison each year. And we've seen, over 100 people come off death row who've been exonerated. We've now had DNA evidence, which has enabled us to see that many, many other people, well over 100 people who were convicted by juries were actually innocent. And I would say the most fundamental reason in most of those cases is because of poor quality of legal representation that people had. But even for people that are guilty, they still have a constitutional right not only to a lawyer, but all their other constitutional rights. And beyond that, our court system is making these decisions every day about who goes to prison, who goes to drug programs, who spends the rest of their life without any possibility of parole, in prison, who gets the death penalty. Those are critically important decisions, and they're supposed to be individual decisions. And if they're going to be individualized decisions, the way in which we treat people who come through the system, even the guilty people, people have to be represented so that judges have the information and advocacy so that they can make individual decisions about what to do.
But Tim Lewis, when...
Yeah, Dick, if I could just follow up on that point. Let's bear in mind, as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, that Mr. Gideon had a very lengthy criminal record also. And finally, when he was afforded a lawyer on the charge that went to the Supreme Court, when it went back to Florida, he was acquitted. The mere fact that someone has been arrested 10, 15, 20 times does not necessarily make them guilty of the crime.
Except that, and you will know this, in terms of making the political case in this country, standing and arguing on behalf of the rights of a Willie Horton-like character as opposed to making the case for the integrity of the judicial system, that's a tough case to sell to politicians.
It may well be, but make it we will, make it we must. These are all tough cases. That's why we are doing what we are doing. Steve mentioned the death penalty area. I was recently involved in a case, the death penalty case, that went to the United States Supreme Court. The case was called Delma Banks. It's a case from Texas. We don't know today whether Delma Banks is guilty of the murder he was charged with, even though he sat on death row for 19 years. And one of the reasons for that, as the Supreme Court found, is because of ineffective assistance of counsel at his trial. 19 years on death row without adequate representation is unacceptable. And it may be a tough case to make to politicians, but we believe that we are up to the task, and we think that the Supreme Court, you know, look, the Supreme Court just said that enemy combatants are entitled to counsel and access to our courts in this country. If enemy combatants,
it was the Supreme Court that said everybody was eligible for fair representation, too.
That's right.
Here
that's
we are exactly 40 years later, and that's not...
That's right. So we need to work on it.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for being with me on the program this hour. Judge Timothy Lewis, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And as co-chair of the National Committee on the Right to Counsel. And Stephen Bright, thank you for coming in.
Sure, thank you.
Stephen is director of the Southern Center for Human Rights and a law professor at Yale University. We talked also with Tom Workman, president of the Massachusetts Association of Court-Appointed Attorneys, and Sam Duhart, who waited in a Georgia jail for 6 months before meeting his court-appointed lawyer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.